the growing calls for prison reform and what they mean for Florida's many correctional institutions. That's just ahead. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you had a nice weekend out there. Be careful out there in that fog this morning. But keep listening as just ahead we take a closer look at the bipartisan push for prison reform. You can get on the line now. Join the conversation at 549-2937. Then later, how to combat this state's red tide and green algae. Holiday colors we don't want, plus Culpepper as the Jaguars' playoff hopes just fade away. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, President Donald Trump last week announced support for a bipartisan prison reform bill called the First Step Act. Now, this new legislation would eliminate provisions that end up with offenders serving consecutive sentences for crimes they committed using firearms, and it would also shorten mandatory minimum sentences, among other things. Corrections officials are already trying reforms in other ways, as they're faced with rising populations and shrinking budgets. And so increasingly what we're seeing are faith-based providers coming into prisons, offering free services to help meet the needs of inmates. Now, there are so many correctional institutions in the state of Florida, so this is an important issue for our state, but it's also a national trend. And someone that's been studying this at length is Dr. Michael Hallett, criminology professor at UNF. And he joins us with more. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good
Thanks
to see you.
Great to be here.
What are your questions about criminal justice reform, particularly prison reform? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And so in a moment, we'll hear about your research. But first, could I get your reaction to this announcement last week from the president? He's announcing support for this bipartisan prison reform bill called the First Step Act. What are your thoughts about that?
A definite positive development. Of course, that affects the federal prison system, and by far most inmates in the United States are at the local level, and the state level, I mean. But, you know, I think the initial first steps, and that's why they call it first steps, are for some sentencing reform, particularly with regard to mandatory sentencing. And so at the federal level, which has just over about 100,000 inmates, I think it's a good place to start. But the question with that will be, will Mitch McConnell,
the Senate
actually
majority leader,
the Senate majority, will he manage to step forward and support it?
We've seen a bipartisan accord on this issue recently. Whether or not Mitch McConnell comes on board, I guess, is an open question. But what do you think's driving this growing consensus across the political spectrum that we need to change the way we handle not just prisons, but all of the different pieces and moving parts of the criminal justice system?
Well, at least in terms of the most recent developments, I think one of the things that's driving it is growing prominence of evangelical involvement in the topic of prison reform. And in particular, with President Trump's recent announcements, the evangelical community has been very vocal in terms of trying to push notions of forgiveness and reentry in criminal justice in general, not just in prisons.
So this is increasingly a faith-based approach, and that's what you've been researching. And it's 549-2937 as we talk prison reform here on the show. Now, you've done a lot of work inside Angola, the Louisiana State Penitentiary, America's largest maximum security prison. And in fact, you've written a book about your research at Angola.
Right. There was we wrote a book myself with four other authors from Baylor University. We did the largest study ever done of prison religion in the United States at Angola, Louisiana State Penitentiary, which is not only the largest maximum security prison, but also arguably the toughest, because inmates at Angola have the longest sentences, average sentences of any prison in the U.S.
Why is that?
Well, because Louisiana has such a harsh sentencing structure. And so at Louisiana State Penitentiary, also known as Angola, former slave plantation, 6,300 inmates on 18,000 acres of a working prison farm, 90% of inmates at Angola die at Angola. So in 1994, the reason we were there, spent 3 years there, surveyed over 2,000 inmates. I spent about 3 months on site overnight at the prison, interviewing the unique faith-based programming at Angola, which dates back to slavery, because inmates used to basically founded their own churches. There are inmate-built churches on the compound of Angola, which still exist. Mm. And so in 1994, when the federal government revoked Pell Grant eligibility for convicted felons, then Warden Burl Kane reached out to New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary to plant a Christian seminary in the middle of America's largest maximum security prison. And so we went out there and studied it. I led the project for 3 years. We wrote a book on it, but we've also now expanded our research to some of the other toughest prisons in the United States, including Parchman and Sing Sing.
In Sing Sing, the most notorious prison maybe of all. And
one
so,
of them, sure.
So faith becomes critical for inmates to just survive the prison experience. And as you write, this is just indicative of the larger issue, which is our correction system is in crisis, in terrible crisis.
It really is. I mean, there's good news and bad news. The good news is, it seems to me, that faith-based engagement in the American correction system really does save money, and it is producing some good results. There are also, I think, some contrary kinds of First Amendment concerns in terms of at what point does introduction of religion into a state prison constitute indoctrination and coercion rather than freely a free commitment to a conversion of faith. And the reason that Angola is important in this conversation is that because no one ever really leaves Angola, a faith conversion really is voluntary at the prison. Now, at the other institutions that we've studied, we have some concerns in regard to the faith-based constitutionality of promoting faith-based programs in the ways that they do.
And it's really extraordinary to note that, as you point out in this book, prisons in 17 states now have prison seminary programs in maximum security prisons. And so much of this is corrections officials who are desperate for help accepting this volunteer labor, essentially.
That's right.
And
that's
so
right.
Let me ask you then, I guess, a deeper question. While you're saying these programs have good results, is this really, though, just an emblematic of a larger failure in our society to fund rehabilitation budgets more appropriately, to find ways to reduce recidivism, people leaving incarceration and then reoffending it right away again and then going right back?
Yeah.
Isn't this, it sounds like this is a Band-Aid on the problem in some sense.
No doubt about it. In some ways, what's happened is that, you know, prison systems are increasingly relying on religious volunteers to provide programming that they should be providing themselves. In other words, we characterize faith-based programming as a form of prison privatization, actually. And, you know, with great consequences, both good and bad, at least in terms of the Christian programs we've studied, however, the evidence is really pretty overwhelming that it achieves two things. It provides a spiritual pathway for self-forgiveness and healing for inmates, but also, equally as important, a community of support that delivers on the promise of forgiveness. So our research shows pretty clearly that offenders fail because they're locked into a life of offending, both spiritually and socially. And we think that faith-based programs provide unique resources to address both of those concerns, both an individual sense of hopelessness as well as a community of support that actually delivers on the promise of forgiveness and puts people back to work and forgives them.
And if you're just tuning in as we speak with UNF criminologist Michael Hallett, what are your questions about prison reform? The bipartisan push for criminal justice reform in this country now, and in particular, how faith-based groups are working in America's largest supermax prisons. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Sharla is on the west side. Hey, Sharla, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. Thank you. I just had a comment. I wanted to say that in addition to improving rehabilitation and reform for people, I really think that sentencing reform and criminal justice reform has the potential to help improve the relationship between the community and the police themselves, really making it safer for officers. And I say that because as a person, I've been in situations where I've seen perhaps something going on in my neighborhood that I didn't like, and I sat and asked myself, should I call the police or not? And I really had to dig deep and ask, why is that even a question? And what I realized is that when one person goes to jail, you know, that family suffers, and they suffer in ways, you know, they have to pay to make phone calls, and they have to worry about their children being brutalized in jail, you know. And so it's a lot more than just the things you think about a lot of times. And so if some of those things were removed, if it was punishment for a person and then rehabilitating that person so that they could be released back to the community in a healthy way, I think that would actually help the community and the police.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. Mike Hallett.
I think that's absolutely right. In fact, the evidence overwhelmingly shows that 80% of state prisoners released from prisons in the United States are rearrested within 3 years.
Right.
Usually going back to the same impoverished neighborhoods that they came from before they went to prison. And one of the reasons that we believe faith-based programs are important is that when you look at high-crime neighborhoods, they are not only financially impoverished, they are also socially impoverished. So faith-based programs really do deliver a measure of social capital that has been missing in otherwise blighted, socially blighted neighborhoods, providing everything from literacy training to employment assistance and other kinds of direct engagement with adult male ex-offenders who are actually your highest risk category for reoffending.
Mm-hmm. And it's 549-2937 as we talk about prison reform here on the show. Here's an email for you. It's Marilyn, and she writes, please talk about who is behind prison reform. The Koch brothers are behind this idea, replacing state institutions often with fewer regulations, more of the profit motive, and potentially poorer quality services. That's Marilyn in Marineland. And so she is right that the Koch brothers and their institute have been a big driver of criminal justice and prison reform. In fact, there was a symposium held here in Jacksonville a year or two ago where they had a presence talking about these issues. But what she sees is a sinister motive, the profit motive, perhaps does not see their impetus behind this as a good one. So what about that perception?
Yeah. Well, I think there's some legitimacy to that view, frankly. You know, if you study the broad history of use of incarceration in the United States, you'll see that during times of economic growth, there's lots of calls to lower the incarceration rate, because in the era of people calling for $15 minimum wages, the active movement is to try to saturate that low-wage labor force. And I think that's absolutely a legitimate concern. At the same time, there's a broader shift, not just with the Koch brothers, but to outsource rehabilitation programming in general, so that today prisons really are run already by a complete medley of different service providers through contracts and through a sort of neoliberal kind of privatized service delivery model, where, you know, the kinds of things that are happening today and that are not happening today are very different. So when people say to me that, well, gee, what's really changed in the American prison system over the last 25 years, my answer to that is a whole lot has changed, and not in good ways.
What would be the biggest negative changes?
Well, we've had a rise in the recidivism rate. There was a big study of reoffending rates in 1994, which showed that about 68% of ex-offenders reoffended. And then a larger study in 2002, which showed actually a rising rate of increase, and highlighted that the longer someone spends in prison, the more likely they are to reoffend. So we are at a point in American criminal justice reform where there's very good evidence to show that our punitive responses to offending have actually made the problem worse. Mm-hmm. And what we need to do is focus on providing people opportunities to behave themselves in good ways, rather than focusing all of our efforts on punishing them and trying to dissuade them from misbehaving.
And in particular, it seems to me when you look at the statistics that Florida is very backwards in this area. We've got 143 Department of Corrections facilities around the state. 10% of Florida's inmates are housed in 7 private prisons. at a cost of $142 million per annum. They've closed some of them, but there are still seven in this state. We're a leader in the private prison industry. And not only, as you said, are we really punitive in this state, we have private-run facilities that have been accused of not keeping inmates safe, not saving on costs, essentially profiting off the incarceration of mainly black and brown bodies. Yeah. And so in Florida, these issues are particularly painful.
No doubt. I mean, one of the bright spots was that Amendment 4 passed. I think there is...
That's the allowing ex-felons
allowing,
to vote.
Allowing ex-offenders to reacquire their right to vote. I think, you know, Florida has the third largest prison system in the United States, a $2.4 billion annual budget. And the only bright spot, it seems to me, is that there are these private providers out there who are doing very innovative things outside of the box, like faith-based programming. It's not going to solve all of our problems. It's not appropriate for everyone. There need to be rules established, it seems to me, for how faith-based programs operate inside prisons. Because, you know, in a lot of cases, prison administrators are more than happy to accept the free labor of volunteers. And I've seen it where, you know, the religious volunteers will displace the education department, kick those people out, and then take over and then set up shop for those inmates, Christian so-called inmates who volunteer. I guess the good news, though, is that there's very strong and overwhelmingly powerful evidence that religious conversion really does result in an abrupt change in behavior that seems to last.
Mike is in Fernandina Beach. Hey, Mike, how are you? Go ahead.
I am well. I think that you're not considering any of the non-religious people who are in prison. So I think the religion needs to be out of the religion, out of the prison system completely. I don't believe that religion has anything to do with what I feel that what the crimes have committed.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah. Thanks for that.
99.9% of the people in prison are religious. What does that say?
Yeah, Mike. Thanks for that question. So for people who are of no faith,
right,
and a growing percentage of Americans are nuns,
that's right,
that have no faith.
Absolutely.
So what about
absolutely
that?
Absolutely. You know, the work we've done explores these religious programs, which actually literally train inmates to be ministers and then send them out as so-called missionaries to other prisons. So there are very serious First Amendment constitutional concerns with regard to some of what is happening. At the same time, what I would tell you is that it is literally the case that were it not for faith-based providers, religious volunteers were unwilling to go into prisons to work with inmates, in many cases they would actually get no rehabilitation programming at all. So we're in a situation, as you pointed out, Melissa, where there's such a sort of hands-off attitude about what's going on in the American prison system that were it not for people willing to step in and provide some services, none would be provided whatsoever.
And when you talk about rehabilitation, what are a few examples of what they're doing to help rehabilitate inmates?
Well, just things like literacy, for example. So if, you know, Florida Department of Corrections, over 60% of inmates in Florida Department of Corrections have a sixth grade achievement level. So they're very behind academically and socially. And so one of the main benefits of having religious volunteers going in to work with inmates is they teach people to read and increase their skill set. And the other thing that we found is that when religious volunteers are engaged with inmates behind the walls of a prison, they're often also engaged for those same inmates when they get out. And so one of the follow-ups is, like right here in Jacksonville, I serve on the Board of Prisoners of Christ. These are religious volunteers who go into prisons and then help ex-offenders get into jobs after they get out. And so those are two tangible benefits right there.
Ann is in Arlington. Hi, Ann. How are you? Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Turn the radio off.
Yeah. Turn your radio down. That's good.
Yeah. I think that the idea of emphasizing religions in the prison is fine and for many people. But I think there are more pressing issues such as violence in the prisons. in solitary confinement. Two or three weeks ago, Canada ended solitary confinement in all its prisons. And you spoke, we are keeping people in solitary confinement for as long as 44 years. Yeah. I'm referring to last name Woodfox. I think it was Alfred Woodfox. I was in solitary confinement in the Angola prison for that long. He was released about a year ago.
I know. I was there.
You were there?
Yeah.
Solitary confinement causes mental illness or exacerbates it. There's a Frontline documentary, which is very hard to watch.
Yeah.
But it covers that thoroughly.
Oh, absolutely.
And also, when people are in prison for long years, when they get out, they're traumatized, trying to get used to normal life. And many of them have PTSD for the rest of their
life. All great points, Anne. And you clearly know a lot about this, so I appreciate the call. So what about Anne's points?
Definitely. I mean, the one thing I would say is that when religious volunteers go into prisons, private citizens go into prison to serve inmates, it makes prisons more transparent. It provides services that inmates otherwise would not have. I couldn't agree more about solitary confinement. It's an atrocious, ineffective, humanly inhumane practice that ought to be abolished, and we use it far too often.
How often is it used?
It's used a lot, especially for administrative segregation. But the reality is that solitary confinement is used to control and fight gangs in prisons, to keep people separated. And so, sadly, one of the primary strategies for keeping people who are otherwise harmful to one another apart is to put people in what they call administrative segregation, which is usually solitary confinement, which has very deleterious effects on mental health.
Yeah. So in the end, it's counterproductive.
Very counterproductive, yes.
Rick on the north side. Go ahead, Rick. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I just want to find out if your guest, thank you, Melissa, for taking my call. The guest believes that or thinks that we are in a police state and it's now being exposed. We're in a police state. There are private prisons that do a lot more torture than the state or the federal, but there's so much torture going on in the prisons and it's behind a police state society that we live on. Do you agree or disagree? Thank you.
Living in a police state. I'm not sure about that. I would say, what I would encourage you to do is go to the Miami Herald and look up, read about some of the things going on in the Florida state prison system.
The abuses in Florida's prisons.
It's not just private prisons.
Okay, but Rick is saying we live in a police state. You don't agree with that. But we do live, is it fair to say, in a carceral state where we incarcerate more people as a percentage than any other modern developed country in the world.
The United States has the world's highest incarceration rate, and we also have the world's highest recidivism rate. our offenders reoffend at a higher rate than anywhere. So obviously something we're doing is not working.
And so in the closing moments we have here, in addition to the faith-based programs that you've written about extensively in the book, what are some other ideas and recommendations you as a criminologist think we as a society should be doing differently?
Well, we need to incentivize good behavior through social capital. We need to develop people and provide them a vesting in good behavior. For too long, the criminal justice system has relied on harsh punishments to discourage people from offending, but offered very few incentives for good behavior for not offending. And one of the things we found, even in the study of faith-based programming, is that when you incentivize good behavior and provide people with an opportunity that they perceive as real and a sense of forgiveness that they can walk forward with, they really do change their behavior. And so what's missing is not that we don't have enough punishment. It's that we don't have enough reward.
And there's more about this in Mick's book. It's The Angola Prison Seminary, Effects of Faith-Based Ministry on Identity. Dr. Michael Hallett of UNF, always good to see you. Thanks for being here. And have a good holiday.
Appreciate it.
Much more still ahead later. Culpepper says the Jaguars' playoff hopes are now, well, just about officially dead. He'll be along later in the hour. But up next, it's the season of red and green here in Florida. Red tide and green algae, that is. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Well, Florida's environmental woes, all our red tide and green algae, they became a big campaign issue in the recent midterm election. Now that the elections are over, we are still checking in to see how these water-based pollutants are affecting the Sunshine State, whether it comes to tourism, sick manatees, or more. Chris Costello is managing organizer of Sierra Club Florida, and she's here with more. Good morning.
Good morning.
So we have red tide and green algae still all over the place, although as winter comes around, hopefully we'll see a lessening of these issues. What's Sierra Club's position on how the state should be responding to all of this?
The state should be responding in pretty much the exact opposite way that it has for the past 8 or more years. The only way to deal with the problem is stopping pollution at its source. That means regulation. If you don't stop the pollution at its source, then it gets into our receiving water bodies and it feeds the algae, whether it's toxic cyanobacteria or toxic red tide. Anything that carries nitrogen and phosphorus, which is generally sewage, manure, and fertilizer. It gets into the water, it feeds it. And so we will not get ahead. We will not fix the problem until we do that. We got to stop it at its source.
Okay. We just had an election where the candidates that are on the side of looser, lighter regulation won. So your response to the political implications?
Truthfully, I have no idea what's going on in decision makers' minds or voters' minds when they vote for the people who have deregulated, have managed to stop enforcing the laws that we have. It makes no sense. The only clue to why is that a lot of dollars are put into the political process by polluters, whether they're big agriculture, big sugar in particular, big wastewater, big industry. But it is, the bottom line, getting back to regulation and stopping pollution at its source, is that source control is paid for by the polluter. And because that is so, we have a lot of campaign dollars going in the opposite direction. When we think about regulation, it is all about who pays. And the system we have now is, let's study the heck out of it. Let's throw money into control and mitigation, not prevention, but control and mitigation. And that relieves the polluters from paying for cleanup and puts the price of cleanup on the taxpayer. And so the taxpayers lose every time mm-hmm. when pollution is not stopped at its source.
What would be an example of a law that's already on the books that you say is not being enforced when it comes to this issue?
Oh, my goodness. There are so many. There are so many. Oh my gosh, mangrove protection, wetland protection, the regulation of biosolids, wastewater treatment. A very good one to bring up is best management practices in agricultural production. Mm-hmm. People know how to stop pollution at its source. It's not rocket science. But in this state, we have voluntary best management practices. We do not have mandatory best management practices. So an agricultural producer can get away by saying, yeah, sure, I'll follow that rule. Does anyone enforce it? No. Does anyone make sure that they are doing what they promised to do? No. And until regulation is mandatory, until best management practices are enforced, we will continue to have what is a steady flow, a smorgasbord provided by polluters to those toxic algae.
Let me ask you too, as a follow-up, Florida is unique in a sense when it comes to these environmental problems because our environment is our economy. we are so dependent on a tourism-based economy and people visiting here to take in the oceans and the beauty of the state. And red tide and green algae certainly are not good for business. And so it's a little different here in that other states, you might hear people argue, well, those regulations will kill our economy. We can't have them. In Florida, the argument's a little different. But still, it hasn't been enough to make the case to become a more regulated state in terms of environmental cleanliness and stopping pollutants at their source. So what's the Sierra Club's advocacy position going forward for the new Ron DeSantis administration, let's say?
Well, so what I think we have to focus on is the difference between the way people vote party-wise and how their lives are impacted. I certainly hope that the voters who voted for Ron DeSantis understand that the last 8 years of no regulation did not help business, right? It is obvious that the deregulation, the defunding of agencies, the anti-science approach did not help business because so many businesses lost over the past, really since 2013, and really in this area even longer. The Green Monster was a decade ago, right? Mm-hmm. Even more than a decade ago. So I hope that citizens that really rose up in the past 6 months because of the algae blooms, both cyanobacterial and red tide, will continue to rise up and demand of the legislature, which really hasn't changed its overall look and feel, and certainly on the governor, continue to put pressure because there is no technological answer. There is no engineering answer to this. It really is preventing it. We have some obstacles. This concentration on control and mitigation, so a cure, and I'm doing air quotes, rather than prevention, is insidious. It's insidious. It comes at us from the federal and the state level. We have to get away from that. What's the old adage? An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Taxpayers, hopefully, will keep on Ron DeSantis, who claimed, with absolutely no record to back it, who has claimed that he cares about water quality. So the proof's in the pudding. We shall see, but folks out there should not let up, no matter who you voted for. It is now our turn again to put the pressure on whoever was elected.
Chris Costello with Sierra Club Florida, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
We'll be right back.
Yeah.
a new restaurant is opening up this week in the old Seminole Club building in downtown Jacksonville. It's in the space of the former Candy Apple Cafe. Ted Hayes is the new general manager for MLG Jack's. That's the name of the new space, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So this is exciting to hear. In the building that also houses the Sweet Pete's Candy Shop, there was this great restaurant, Candy Apple. It closed, but now we've got a new place opening up. Tell us about MLG Jack's.
Well, great. MLG Jacksonville is a second location that is coming out of the Chicago area, which stands for Marcus Lemonis Grill. It's a new age style American restaurant that features items such as homier trends like fried chicken, ribs, but then some classic things like grouper and some very fancy dishes as well. We try to marry elegance and approachability as well, at the same time.
Now, Marcus Lemonis, of course, is the host of the CNBC show The Prophet. He's the reason that Sweet Pete's was able to set up shop in the old Seminole Club and really see success there. So he's keeping his hand in this space. What motivated this whole move to bring the restaurant to the building, as well as what he's already done to invest in the candy place?
Well, when the opening became available, he decided to move in one of his flagship restaurants, which was the MLG. And of course, he owns several businesses. This is one of the few that actually carries his name. So I think he was always been impressed with the success of the old Seminole Club location. And he definitely saw a great opportunity in moving in something to see if it has any potential for further growth.
You are also employing a well-known chef from around town, Chef Roderick Smith. And he will be in charge in the kitchen.
Yeah, he's a really excellent chef, and we're lucky to have him. And of course, most people in Jacksonville might know him better as actually Sweet Pete. He had one of the first original food trucks that actually sat outside Square One in San Marco. And if you're in the mm-hmm. food and restaurant business from 10 years ago, so you always went out there after work to get some of his great cuisine.
Right.
And we've moved him into our space, and we're really, really happy that he's there controlling the kitchen.
Now, this is exciting, too, for people that have long wanted to see more downtown restaurants and bars. You're going to be adding to that, making sure that that space stays activated. How important is that to the ownership and the management?
Well, it's important to us, the ownership, the management. We also think it's important to the city of Jacksonville as well, because we're really happy with that location, though, and the location that we anchor that side of Hemming Plaza, and really feel that it's important for us to hold down our end over there. And the candy store itself, Sweet Pete's, has such a great traffic, and people love to come in, and they're so excited. And so they've been lost for the last few months now that the whole building's been under renovation. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone's just excited to reopen. And we're excited as a restaurant entity to be reopened with them at the same time.
What all went into that renovation, and how has that affected your opening?
We've changed the decor of the previous restaurant. We've added in a lot of warmer tones, different lighting, a little less whimsy, but a lot more comfort. And the upstairs, Sweet Pete's in the third floor, is now got a great new toy store. And a lot of restoration to some of the historic notes. So for instance, one of the biggest historical features of the building is the foyer. It's really wood grain, and it's left over from the Seminole Club exactly. A lot of restoration work went into that foyer as well.
You know, for people that have only been in the building since it's been recast, if you never had the chance to go into that building before, you wouldn't realize the history and the significance of what that building used to be. It really was an old style gentleman's club.
Yeah, there's none like it anymore.
Yeah.
And we're really happy. We really feel the presence when you're in the building of the history that's there, 1903, and a lot of movers and shakers from early industry times in Jacksonville move in and out of that building. And we've got a lot of great historical photos in our foyer that show that that era.
Okay, so with all of that said, MLG Jack's opens up. We're not sure of the opening date, but it's this week.
Definitely this week.
Are you still doing a lot of last-minute touches?
There's a few lighting things that we're still working out, but nothing major. Nothing to hold us up from either a Wednesday or a Friday open.
Wednesday or Friday open?
Yes, ma'am.
People need to start making reservations?
We'll be taking reservations as early as Tuesday.
Really?
That's correct.
And you're the general manager, so you seem pretty calm in the midst of all this, I have to tell you.
Well, it's taking
you
a
seem very, very relaxed. Is that an act, or are you just that kind of guy?
Well, I try to stay as relaxed as I can be, but anybody that works with me closely will know that there are some moments.
Yeah, I'm sure there are. The pressure's on. Now, by the way, will this show be, will this restaurant be seen on The Profits? Or not?
That is a question that only Marcus Lemonis can answer.
I see. Is he going to be around for the opening?
Yeah, he's very close to all his businesses. I don't think he'll be in town this week per se, but I'm sure he'll be in town very soon to check it out. He was definitely here to look at our progress last week, and he was real happy with the restaurant, and he's excited for us to open as well.
It's the new MLG Jacks opening up in the former Candy Apple Cafe, probably by Friday at the latest. So check it out. Another new place to go for lunch, dinner, drinks, events, and more. Ted Hayes, the new general manager for MLG Jacks. That's from Marcus Lemonis. Thanks for being with us.
No, thanks so much for having me, Melissa.
And in a moment, Cole Pepper, as the Jaguars blew a 16-point lead against the Steelers, and their playoff hopes are slowly fading away. We'll have a look at sports with Cole right after this.
In 1962, technology developed for the space program saved the life of an 11-year-old girl during open-heart surgery. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Linda Buckmaster, author of Space Heart, a memoir in stages. We'll discuss the real first Thanksgiving and the Veterans Legacy Program in St. Augustine. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
People have crowded into the municipal sports complex in Tijuana, but not for a game. Several thousand Central American families are laying out their blankets and backpacks. They've done this at every stop on their 1,000-mile trek through Mexico. Now they're just a one-hour walk from the U.S. border. We ask migrants about the challenges they faced in Tijuana and about what they expect at the border crossing into America. It's on the World.
This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
You push a button on your phone and food shows up, which has restaurants questioning their operations.
How will that torta travel? You know, how far can it go before it's dead? So it's almost like you're running an entirely different business.
I'm Amy Scott. How meal delivery apps change the game, next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
The FBI has been a popular target for sitting and past presidents. Watergate, Iran-Contra, spying after 9/11, they all threatened to undo the Bureau. Under attack again, who will prevail this time? Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Tim Weiner on the enemies of the FBI. Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, the Jaguars blow a 16-point lead, and in the process, they have likely lost any chance of making the playoffs.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
It's the sixth straight loss for the Jaguars. Culpepper says, you can probably kiss those Super Bowl hopes goodbye. Hey, Cole.
Yeah, you know, when you think about the expectations for this season, not just set by the fans, but set by the team and the players. Mm-hmm. In the team meeting room, and I referenced this in the preseason, there are two signs up at the front of the team meeting room of the Jaguars facility. One is the AFC South, and the other is the Lombardi Trophy. Uh-huh. So their goals plainly stated and put on display for all to see, win the division, win the Super Bowl. That means that the expectations were as high as they have ever been here in Jacksonville, which I think makes this season the most disappointing season in Jaguars history. It's not the worst season in terms of the record and so forth. At least it's not going to be because they've won three games. But how they finish the season is almost immaterial at this point. Even if they were to win out, they would have to have so many things happen for them in order to make the playoffs that I don't believe that, the perfect storm is going to happen.
The window's closing, yeah.
For this year, and, you know, the 16-point loss is the, blown lead is the largest blown lead at home in Jaguars history. And it, came with 5 seconds to play with Ben Roethlisberger diving in. A lot of criticism about the Jaguars in terms of the play calling and the execution with the offense. The defense had a very good game. But when you only score 16 points, it's hard to win many games in the National Football League, particularly against an offense as potent as the Pittsburgh Steelers. Jaguars gave a good fight, but for the second straight week, they couldn't close out the game in the final minutes. Here's linebacker Telvin Smith.
I'm not going to say we lost our edge at the end, but I'm going to just say that at the end, because we definitely played hard all the way through, man, to the last snap, till he dove in. I'm going to just say, damn.
That's about all he could say.
That's all you can say.
Yeah. I mean, you're shaking your head, whatever you want to say. The Jaguars put so much emotionally into this game as well. By the way, the Doug Marrone said, all right, take Monday off, and then we'll get back here on Tuesday and get back to it as they look ahead to the rest. Usually Monday off is for, Victory Monday. If you win a big game, you give them the day off. Then you get back to work on Wednesday. So they're not missing days of work, but there was so much put into this. They're going to have to sort of reposition their minds and look forward for the rest of the season. About 2 hours before the game kicked off, ESPN's Adam Schefter reported that sources around the NFL were telling him that the Jaguars were going to trade Jalen Ramsey in the offseason. The Jaguars quickly issued a denial, but Ramsey went on to intercept two passes in the game, had a terrific game afterwards. He told us in the locker room that he knew about the report, but that he didn't use it as additional motivation.
I didn't use it as motivation. It is what it is. I don't control that. All I control is what I put out there on the field. When the offseason comes, we'll have some conversations to have. Either that or I'm gonna get a contract extension or something.
Hmm. Obviously, a guy who has been outspoken in the offseason throughout the year, to say the least, and not somebody who enjoys. I mean, he really takes losing hard. It's part of his competitive spirit, but. Everybody in that locker room knew about that report, and they knew. And
it was hanging over everything, right?
And yet, the defense came out and played arguably their best game of the year, and Ramsey had his best game, first time he's ever had two interceptions in the same game. So what's next now for the Jaguars? From the schedule standpoint, they go to Buffalo in a game that should have been the second consecutive game against the team they beat in the playoffs last year, and which it technically still is, and Doug Marrone's returned to his former employer. But now it's all about, can the Jaguars keep it together and not have the train go completely off the rails over the last 6 weeks of the season, because they are a team right now in free fall with six straight losses and not looking like they're ready to contend or compete at this point with all the expectations that have been heaped on them.
It's not good for us. It is good news for the script writers of the show, The Good Place.
There's plenty to be used there, particularly for Ted Danson's evil character.
That's right, exactly. Okay, let's talk college football.
All right, this week, a lot of big games, as always, on Thanksgiving week. Florida State is Saturday, and this game has some real meaning. Florida State needs to win to keep their 36-year string of going to bowl games alive. It's the longest streak in college football. They were able to get there thanks to a victory over a ranked team, Boston College, on Saturday. This game is in Tallahassee. We'll see how it all plays out. Florida has something to play for as well, a win, and the Gators are likely heading to a New Year's Day bowl game in Dan Mullen's first year. And this will also be the best gauge we have of comparing Dan Mullen to Willie Taggart, the first-year head coaches of those two schools, to see how they match up against one another. They're going to be linked as long as they're at those schools. Georgia, meanwhile, faces Georgia Tech, a win there. They can go on to face Alabama in the AFC or the SEC championship game. And so if they win out, Georgia should be in the college football playoffs.
Nice.
Interesting to see what's going to happen with UCF. They continue to win. They won arguably their biggest game, beating Cincinnati this week. And if they win against USF on Friday, it will be two straight seasons undefeated. I think they deserve a shot in the college football playoff. I don't think they're going to get it, but I think they deserve it. I'd like to, you know, whoever plays Alabama in the first round is probably going to get throttled. So let it be UCF. Why not?
Why not?
Let them have their chance to get pummeled by the Crimson Tide. Mm-hmm. Also, high school football, several area teams, seven of them, in fact, are still alive. Mandarin, Lee, Trinity Christian, Bulls, who will play one another. Rains and West Nassau face off on Friday, and also University Christian, all still alive as they try to earn a spot in the state semifinals.
Good luck to them all. And follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper. Check him out on the Mark Brunell Show. That's tonight.
It is.
Yeah, on the CW.
7 o'clock.
And on Channel 4 every night. And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Our director is Michelle Corum. The show theme by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chepchik. 1A's up next. And if you missed anything from this morning's show, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great day. We'll be back again at 9 a.m. tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.